And the title of a public lecture given by our next guest from the University of Warwick. What do secret policemen really do? How does a real-life totalitarian secret police go about watching citizens, shutting down dissent, and ensuring mass obedience? Mark Harrison brought modern social science together with historical evidence to show how the KGB, the Soviet Union's secret police, worked to uphold the communist monopoly of power during the Cold War. It was the headline and a little piece that got our attention, and we thought we'd get Mark Harrison on our program this evening. Mark, good evening, or good morning where you are. Welcome.
Good evening, Paul.
Nice to have you along.
Thank you for the invitation. It's great to reach out all that distance.
Yeah. Now, let's start talking about the KGB. I looked up what that actually stood for in Russian. I don't think I can pronounce it. It's a very long name.
it stands for the Committee of State Security. Komitet Государственной Безопасности.
There you go. I can see why everyone just says KGB. Is it and we're going to specifically talk about the Lithuanian KGB because that's the collection I believe you've had, intimate access with. But the KGB is a Russian invention?
Every nasty regime you can think of has always had a secret police.
Right.
The Bolsheviks, developed a secret police very quickly after they came to power. That was in 1917. The head of the first, communist secret police was, Felix Dzerzhinsky, who's a Polish adherent of the Bolshevik Party. And essentially, they applied modern methods to a very traditional concern.
Right.
The secret police became a powerful part of the regime.
So, in a totalitarian situation, you've got to have a secret police like that. Otherwise, things don't operate, I take it.
Absolutely. So there are two things, really. One is that dictators take decisions in secret, and there has to be something to enforce the secrecy. If you think about our modern open Western societies, of course, governments have secrets, but there are leaks all the time. You just can't trust civil servants, policemen, people like Edward Snowden. They're leaking to the press all the time. There has to be an agency that will stop all that and hold things down. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is that they had to control dissent because they wanted to keep themselves in power. So they had to have an organization to monitor society and work out what people were thinking and what they might do and head them off before it happened.
So you're really talking about mass, having the capability of, and we hear that term a lot now, mass surveillance.
Absolutely.
How do you go about that in an analog, or how did they go about that in an analog world, where I guess comms were on paper and, a bit later on, telephone calls? What did you have to stand on street corners and listen literally to what people were saying?
Well, in many ways, it was a lot simpler. So it began just with knowing where everybody lived. So everybody was registered to a place of residence and personal ID. Whenever they took power in any country, they always took over the archives, so they knew people's personal histories, what parties they belonged to, what they'd said in public, and so on. But then it was down to controlling the mail, the telephones, controlling how people traveled. You could travel around within the country fairly freely, but on the other hand, a lot of people had restricted rights. There were a lot of places with restrictions on who could move in. And a rigid control on travel abroad. Pretty soon they learned how to keep tabs on the people that they saw as potential troublemakers.
Yeah. Of course, you don't need to use those services to stay anonymous, though. You can sort of stay under the radar, can't you, if you're not making phone calls, not writing letters?
Sure, you can stay under the radar, but in that kind of society, if you were staying under the radar, that meant you really did nothing. And as long as you did nothing, the KGB considered that you weren't a threat.
So it wasn't quite to thought crime, but it was just, as long as you don't cause any problems, we're sort of not interested.
Well, I think thought crime is to some extent a kind of, there are two levels to this, right? One is that in many ways the KGB didn't care what you really believed.
Right.
What it cared about was what you said and what you did. As long as you professed loyalty, that was fine. And that was an important prop to the system because you think of me as an individual. If I'm sitting there feeling frustrated and angry at the regime, and all around me, everybody else is saying, oh, I support the government, I'm for communism and so on, I'm going to think, well, I must be crazy. I should just keep quiet and keep these things to myself, or other people will think I'm crazy. So having everybody just give lip service to the regime was a very important part of what kept it going. Now, Stalin was a devious guy. So you go back to an earlier period, the 1930s. And Stalin understood that people who profess loyalty can still turn traitor. And indeed, he had a religious education, and you remember the story of St. Peter, who denied Christ after the crucifixion. And Stalin understood that even people who thought they were loyal could turn on you in a pinch. So he was concerned about thought crime, but not really the thought crime of people who were thinking disloyal thoughts. He was concerned about the people who thought they were loyal and yet would still turn on you.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, it was...
If you're one of those people, you're in a very difficult position with that.
Yeah, Stalin called them unconscious enemies.
Oh, dear.
And those who became aware of this idea became, there are diaries. You know, people wrote diaries. One of them wrote, how can I be sure that I'm loyal?
Oh,
it's a dilemma. Yeah.
And I guess also if you look too loyal, that could ring alarm bells too. People start thinking, well, what's this guy on about? He's
Stalin understood this too. Stalin once said, the best cover for a spy is a party membership card.
I take it to keep that system operating as designed, you also have to limit the flow of outside information as well, because you can't have people being able to reference another society or another way of living to compare to yours.
Absolutely. So they did all they could to enforce their own monopoly on the media. They stamped out independent publication. They controlled people coming to the country rigidly. I was a student in Moscow in the early 70s, and I was fairly regularly traveling backwards and forwards. And the thing I hated most was just having all my bags open to check for books, newspapers, this sort of thing.
Right.
They really rigidly screened out all that kind of thing.
I remember seeing the movie The Life of Others, which is one of my favorite movies.
Uh-huh.
And the whole thing around typewriters, I didn't realize that there was an obsessive tracing system of typewriters. And they could tell what brand of typewriter something was typed on. And they'd know how many of that particular make of typewriter were in the country. And if it came from one they didn't know about, they knew that there was someone out there writing stuff they shouldn't. It's amazing.
Yes. In the files that I'm looking at, there's a lot of stuff from the 50s, 60s, 70s about anonymous leaflets. People would produce anonymous leaflets and leave them in public places, protesting against the regime, protesting against this and that. And they're either handwritten or typewritten. And there was a whole industry of graphologists for handwriting and typewriter experts, looking at the way the particular characters were worn, what made what brand, but also trying to track it down to the particular machine.
Yeah.
To see who had produced these leaflets. There's a lot of documentation of this sort of thing.
So you'd really have to hide your typewriter.
Yes.
Mm.
And of course there was a rigid control of things like photocopying.
Yes, that must have sent them nuts, the invention of the photocopier.
Well, yes. So you can imagine nowadays with scanners. That would be a difficult one, yeah.
So was there such a, I guess there was in its own context, a thing as big data? Because you sort of need a level of data, don't you, to be able to effectively operate this machinery?
Yes, so it was big data of a previous era. And the important thing, one important thing is that big data then was much, much smaller than it is now.
Hmm.
But it was personal records, both the records that they could inherit and archive, so they could study people's personal histories, the records of their communication, letters, phone calls. One thing to bear in mind, for example, is today, you and I, we pick up the phone to call across continents or we Skype each other. In those days, there was one state telephone company and you couldn't dial up anything more than within the town that you lived in.
Yeah, well, we forget that.
So to speak to another city, you had to go through the exchange. To make an international call, you had to book it through the exchange. So it was relatively easy to keep tabs on those sorts of things.
Well, as a matter of course, they'd be listening to those calls, wouldn't they?
They could choose what to listen to. I mean, the KGB was a small organization, and it did not have the resources to monitor everything, to open everything, but it didn't need to.
I'm surprised you said they were a small operation. I guess off the top of your head, you'd think that they would be everywhere.
Well, it's I think a salutary reminder of whether we have things in proportion nowadays. So Lithuania is a country of around 3 million people. There was around 1,200 full-time KGB employees in the sort of 60s and 70s. On top of that, they had another sort of 10,000-12,000 informers. If you total that up, it comes to about 4 per 1,000.
Right.
You know, they were spread thinly, but they were they knew where to focus things.
I was going to ask you that with that sort of level of resource, how do you know where to start? I guess like you are today, and our algorithms do that. You look for patterns of behaviour to reveal, to single out who to look at.
So again, there's two aspects to this. So one is they knew who were the troublemakers, and the troublemakers would be the young people and the educated people. So they focused informers wherever these were to be found. So that means schools, colleges, high-tech facilities, research facilities, the parts of the economy that were growing rapidly. That meant they were recruiting rapidly and recruiting young, skilled people, so, you know, defense plants and so on. So that's where they focused their resources. And that meant that there's large stretches of the society that weren't really being watched by the KGB. Lots of the countryside, farms and so on. They were being watched by the party, by other organizations, but not by the KGB itself. So that's about focusing resources. But the other thing is, as you say, they screened and they profiled. So, you know, they have this idea that, you know, this is a communist state. We live in a planned society where everything is organized according to the directives of the Communist Party, and so on. So things that happen that aren't in those directives need to be looked into. You know, some kind of new, unexpected development, anything that's abnormal, what's going on? Who's behind it? Are the foreigners at work? Is it foreign ideas at work? So these are the kind of things that the KGB did. They tried to work out what is normal. If it's abnormal, something could be wrong. And then they look into it. So that applied to events, anything that was unexpected, that happened unexpectedly, a train is late, there's a sudden gathering of people, what's going on? But also people. They screened people. And they had a very clear idea of the sort of people who might turn out to be unreliable. And for that, they were interested in your political history, your social history, and who you were mixing with. Did you go to church? What kind of jokes you told? Did you listen to Western radio? This kind of stuff. These are the kind of things that they were looking at all the time.
And how often would they update that information on their target individuals? Was it like real-time monitoring, or would how would they make that decision? Because you mentioned only, 1,200 full-time employees there. They can only do so much.
Well, so that they always had a set of open files on people that they were watching, and they would be assigning informers to people that they watched and giving them tasks to find out what this person was doing or thinking. I mean, it wasn't necessarily easy and it wasn't necessarily efficient. So they had trouble recruiting informers. They were always wary that they were recruiting too many people who were unsuitable because they were alcoholics or lived a bizarre way of life, this sort of thing. And there are plenty of cases where, you know, they recruited informers who did nothing, who just drifted along and so on. So it's not like it was a smooth operation. You can find plenty of things that look like incompetence or idiocy or corruption. Well, actually not so much corruption as just, taking the money and doing nothing.
I sort of get the impression.
Nonetheless, it worked. That's the thing. It was effective for the place and time.
I sort of get the impression there's an element to, well, if you're going to live in this society where you've got a job and a place to live and all these things in this sort of ideal communist sort of society, then you have to play your part. And if you don't, then we're going to penalize you for that. It was like an obligation that you had to behave to if you're going to receive these benefits.
There's a huge grain of truth in what you just said. It evolved a bit as time went by. If you go back to the 1930s, things were very brutal. You play along or we shoot you, and we ask questions afterwards. It was a very punitive, unforgiving regime. By the 50s and 60s, it had evolved into something that was, you know, arguably kinder, and indeed they thought of themselves as having become kinder and more humane. You know, we won't shoot you, we'll try and put you right.
Right.
And they had worked out by this stage a very simple thing, which is that not everybody who crosses the line necessarily means to. Not everybody who crosses the line is lost forever. You can think of them like lost sheep. We can bring them back. And in a way, they had to do this because so many of the people crossing the line were the young, educated products of Soviet society. You know, by the 60s and 70s, these are people who were born under communism. They're educated under communism. They're the young people we want to lead our country in the future. And if they're crossing the line, then we have to bring them back, because otherwise we'll be shooting our future.
The management of the KGB, and we're talking Lithuania in this case, were they, you know, dedicated, sort of brainwashed, anything for the regime types, or were they just in jobs? How were they chosen? How did they have to sort of come across to their leaders?
So you're talking about the rank and file officers.
I'm talking about the.
I'm a bit cold this morning, and I'm just.
Bless you. I'm talking about the management, the people who ran the thing, you know, the top brass. Were they, very strongly supportive of the political regime? Had they been sort of brainwashed into defending that, or were they just filling out good jobs in a public service?
I don't think you should think of them as brainwashed. They were professional people trying to do a job.
Right.
And at the top, they were, you know, very competent, very clever people. Someone like Yuri Andropov, who ran the KGB in the 60s and 70s and eventually became the leader of the country. You know, he was a very competent guy. At the same time, he was very conventional. You know, these people had very conventional ideas for the place and time. And as far as they were concerned, they were just trying to do a job. They weren't particularly, you know, they weren't erudite and particularly well-read. They weren't particularly cultured or reflective. They were just doing a job, and their job was to keep society on the right lines.
Hmm.
You know, they had you could think of it as a sort of ideology of order. You know, when things are in order, that's when everything is right. And people who cause disorder, they're troublemakers. We have to understand them in order to know whether to help them or arrest them. But one way or another, we need to keep things nice and straight and tidy. And you should think of them, they're not brainwashed. They've been brought up in a particular way of thinking about the world. That's the ideas that they have. They don't question them, but they're going to try and implement them.
With what you say there, how should we think of then of Vladimir Putin, who has a KGB or a security service background? I'm not sure if it was exactly with the KGB. Would he be in that category of person or something else?
I think very much. So, again, he seems to sort of fit the profile of somebody who's competent, has a deeply entrenched view of the world. He's a patriot. He believes in order. He believes in power. And, you know, we don't really know a lot about Putin as a person. The one thing that always sticks in my mind, he wrote this in a memoir that was published around the year 2000.
Hmm.
He describes his an evaluation. He was evaluated in the KGB, and his commanding officer told him that his one defect was he had a lowered sense of danger.
Oh.
He didn't take enough notice of risks. And, I think about Russia's behavior in the world today, and it continually comes back to mind. But it's just a little anecdote, really, and you kind of attach too much significance to it. But I do see Putin taking a lot of risks nowadays.
We've obviously been following the stories lately regarding NSA and, you know, digital data being stored, etc. I'm looking, going back again to the Lithuanian KGB collection, 1.5 million pages of documents on microfilm and on or in electronic format. Doesn't seem like much at all.
Well, as I said, it's a small country. It's 1,200 people are producing those.
Well, maybe that's a lot for 1,200
pages. It's I mean, there's a sense in which it's just the tip of an iceberg, because the KGB had many sort of regional offices where there's also paperwork. You know, this is just the, really the central paperwork. And then they took quite a quantity of their records back to Moscow at the end of the 80s. They took all the agent files, for example. A few minutes ago I spoke about informers. Every informer had a personal file and a working file. So the personal file held their bio data. The working file held the records of their interactions with the KGB. All these went back to Moscow. So one problem that the Lithuanians have now is they have records with a lot of code names. They don't really know who was behind the code names.
Right.
In terms of who is helping the KGB. So that's a very complex issue, which involves privacy, criminal responsibility, all sorts of things. So consider Nazi Germany the standard of comparison, right? This is a very well documented dictatorship. They wrote down everything. Hmm. You know, we had Stalin's signature on all sorts of terrible things. You know, one of the problems of Holocaust history is Hitler never signed anything. Stalin did. And you look at the records of the entire dictatorship across the country, that's 70 years of country of a couple of hundred million people. There are hundreds of millions of pages of documents. It's astonishingly well documented.
That's interesting that he'd sign them, that Stalin would sign the documents. Either that's stupid, because in the end people are going to find out that you signed away all sorts of things, or you're thinking that this will never end, this is how it's always going to be, I have no need to hide this, it's never going to change.
It's absolutely the latter. They had this.
Well, that's enormous arrogance, isn't it? That's huge arrogance.
The strongest part of their belief was that what we have done is forever. The new rules for society that they were setting forth were for all places and all times. There's a very funny story in the memoir of Menachem Begin, who later became Israeli Prime Minister. He was arrested by the Soviet secret police in 1940 in Lithuania, and he was interrogated for a long time about his activities in pre-war Poland. And he kept saying to them, look, what I was doing in Poland before the war was perfectly legal, under the laws of Poland at the time. And his interrogator once said to him, you know, Menachem Volkovich, you're such a strange guy. Don't you understand? Our laws are for all places and all times. Either you come to us or we'll come to you.
Personal delivery.
Yes.
There were other KGBs, obviously the Russian, Soviet KGB. I think Estonia and Georgia had their operations as well. Did they network together and share information?
Oh, yes. I mean, this was effectively one centralized
right.
state.
Hmm.
And so they all worked under the direction of Moscow.
Right.
There was very, they consulted with the local political authorities. But ultimately, they were commanded by Moscow. It was highly centralized.
I want to start sort of trying to draw a few comparisons about what we've been debating in more recent times, and, you know, big data and mass surveillance, and we're in a different sort of era in terms of technology. One quote that stood out in some of the material, I think you used it, was the former chief of the CIA and Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, quoted as saying in the New York Times, many people will remember this, if you're looking for a needle in the haystack, you need a haystack.
Yes.
If you don't have a haystack, I guess you're going nowhere. So, I guess 1.5 million pages when it comes to the Lithuanian KGB collection is a sort of a haystack.
Yes, but by modern standards, you're right. It is a tiny haystack. And the reason for that is simply that today we have hugely augmented technological possibilities to communicate and to travel, and we use them. So we live in a relatively open, free society. We're always online. We're emailing. We're chatting. We're tweeting. And we're also traveling. I mean, let me give you one other figure. In around the end of the 70s, Lithuania was sending around, I forget the exact figures, but the order of magnitude is right around 10,000 citizens abroad every year to the Western countries. It was receiving around 1,500 visitors. Okay? So 1,500 visitors in a year. So around 2011, 2012, Lithuania received 1 million visitors.
Wow.
The European Union alone.
It's incredible.
You think of the scale of modern travel. It's on a vastly greater scale than back in those days. And essentially, when you look at Lithuania in the 60s and 70s, it's a very closed society. People are, people's circles of contact and communication and travel are very limited. And that made them easy to watch. And the important thing is, it was the system that made it so limited. I mean, it wasn't just technology, but they controlled. They ensured that people could not communicate with each other except through these official channels. They controlled the number of exit and entry visas to limit them to the number of people they could watch. Why did fewer people go abroad than came in? Because it's harder to watch them abroad. Every time people went abroad, they sent people with them to watch them.
That's right. They had escorts, didn't they? Political escorts, things like that.
Yeah. When people came into the country, it was a lot, the infrastructure was there, so they could watch them more easily. So they could allow more people in than they allowed out.
So what do you make then of the current issues with mass surveillance? Just hearing you talk with the explosion in comms and travel and all of that, and keeping track of people, and there are some nasty groups around the place, as we know. Well, it's probably no wonder that you would try and assemble a haystack and invent software to sift through it. It would seem like a reasonable response. Or am I missing something there?
I think it's a reasonable response. I have two reactions. One is that in many ways, the task of counterterrorism is preventive. And just as the task of the KGB was preventive. But they're trying to prevent different things. So the KGB was trying to prevent any kind of threat to a political regime that was firmly in place and wanted to stay there forever. Our intelligence agencies should be trying to counter terrorist threats. There are terrorist threats. As you say, there are bad people out there, and we need to keep an eye on them. The task of our intelligence agencies, I think, is much, much more difficult than the task of the KGB, because there's so much more to watch. So in that sense, I'm sympathetic to the argument that we need a degree of mass surveillance. I do wonder whether we have so much of it that it's beyond our control. I think one of Stalin's insights that we should bear in mind today is that Stalin always wanted a small security agency, because a small security agency was one that he could control. He didn't want a security agency that was over-resourced and under-managed, that could be corrupted or have employees go off on their own little projects like Edward Snowden, or could pose a political threat. And in some ways, we've given so much money to the National Security Agency in America, to the GCHQ in Britain. Can we be really sure what they're doing? And here, I don't think the threat is so much one of setting out to cramp down on our political liberties or bring about a coup d'etat. It's simply the sort of ambition and incompetence that results in, I suppose you could think, private abuse.
Overreaching.
You think we have tens of thousands of intelligence analysts whose main chance of promotion is probably to discover something significant, to discover a threat. And there's going to be, there's a huge risk of all the time finding what a statistician would call false positives. People who you think might be terrorists who aren't really. You know, and again, you think, you know, anybody with a beard and a turban is at risk of being fingered by these people as a security threat, when most of them will not be. One or two of them might be. But we end up paying a high price for a very overdeveloped, costly security system
that might overreach. I'm just thinking also technology is in the mix there too. I guess if you're going back to the more analog days of mass surveillance, you know, we're talking about the typewriter before, you've actually got to go physically find a typewriter. When some smart computer scientist comes up with an algorithm that can search 100 billion web pages in 20 seconds, you're going to probably try and find work for that algorithm.
Yes. Again, you know, if you think of the professional motivation of the KGB officer, here too, you have people with a professional motivation. They're developing ideas and techniques, and they want to put them into practice. It's a bit like Google, developing Google Glass. What are they going to do with it? It's clear to me that a lot of people are not going to like it. But nonetheless, someone's invented it, and they want to see it put into operation. So I see a lot of overextension here.
Another comparison too, going back to those days and comparing it with now, and that is the relationship with other institutions in society. One of the things that you hear people feeling a little insecure about is that big data, not only used for finding baddies, but also, you know, looking out, trying to get an economic advantage with one economy against another, so on and so forth. Which I guess then starts to involve other institutions and other players in a society. The KGB was a bit about protecting economic or state businesses, as well as keeping people in line in the way they thought and carried out their ideas in society. There was an economic part to it, wasn't there?
Well, yes, in the sense that they... one of the professed motivations of Soviet secrecy was to prevent the West from discovering our new technologies, the secrets of our advantage in this or that field. And the KGB was involved in reports and secrecy, so it was involved in that. I mean, the KGB abroad engaged in commercial and state espionage. I guess the most famous example is probably the Manhattan Project. Which was to some degree penetrated by the Soviet secret police at the time. I mean, you're right to say that we have to understand, you know, the secret police within the system of power. And as I said, one of the things that enabled the KGB to operate more successfully was the very system was designed to limit people's ability to communicate and to travel and so on and so forth. And so I always think that when you look at the role of surveillance agencies today, the moment to become very frightened is when you see security people saying, you know, Skype's not such a good idea. It lets people communicate in ways that we can't easily monitor because the servers are abroad. What about Gmail? You know, Google has its servers abroad. How do we penetrate Gmail? Maybe we should limit access to Twitter. And of course, there are countries around the world that do exactly that. China's done it for a long time. Russia is doing it more and more. And those are bad signs.
Well, I was thinking of the United States when I mentioned that, other institutions. You mentioned Google and some of the big, you know, data and internet companies. They have let data go to surveillance operations, haven't they? They've willingly done that.
To me, that's okay. So there, I think you have to deal with this question: is there a trade-off between security and freedom? Which is much argued in political circles, and it should be. I'm always tended towards quite a sort of old-fashioned view, which is, you know, what is national security for? Is it to keep us safe in our beds? Or is it to protect the kind of society that we want to live in? These two objectives may not be the same thing, because to keep our freedoms, we maybe have to take a few risks. I like the idea that we live in a free society, that we live in an open, tolerant society, and we want to keep it that way. And that might mean that we have to limit the ambitions of the security agencies and limit their ability to draw on private records in order to carry out their functions. So I agree with you. It's not something that I like. But I also see that from the point of view of the government in power, keeping us safe in our beds is crucial, because if they don't keep us safe in our beds, there's a huge row about it. So probably what I'm saying is not very in tune with the popular mood.
Right. I was just thinking, the US, for example, bugged Angela Merkel's cell phone, didn't they? I mean, what sort of information would you get from the personal phone conversations of the leader of a country? You would get a lot of really amazing information, wouldn't you?
That I kind of doubt.
Really? Oh, okay.
And I doubted it in the sense that, you know, you look at, say, at all the diplomatic, US diplomatic correspondence that's come out on WikiLeaks. What did it tell us? It told us what we knew already. It told us what US policy was on a whole range of countries. It told us, you know, roughly speaking, you know, the attitude of American leaders to this or that issue or person. But it was, on the whole, pretty close to what they said in public.
And
that's, it's true, it works in many contexts. I mean, even if you look at the Soviet dictatorship, what Stalin wrote in his private correspondence wasn't far from what he wrote in public. Of course, he wrote about a lot more issues that he never wrote about in public at all. But nonetheless, I think there's a limit to what really can be gained. I think bugging Angela Merkel's phone was just silly.
Yeah. Is that one of those circumstances where if we can, we will, without sort of thinking about it too carefully?
Yes, I think so. Hmm. It's it's a risk, and again, it's a sign of undermanagement. You have an organisation that's too big to keep proper control over.
Could you argue, Mark, that these big reveals have actually been pretty good for the security agencies in the West, because it sort of clears the decks? Once everybody's got over the initial shock and go, that's old news, they can sort of get on with the job and not be bothered.
Oh, I see. I thought you were going to... Yes. I doubt they see it that way.
Right, okay.
I'm... fairly confident.
The reason I mention that is it's like you said that what came out is pretty well what everybody thought anyway. So in the end, it's sort of a bit of shock horror, but big deal.
No, I think we've learned quite a lot from all this. I don't think it has just told us what we knew already. I think we've learned that there's a lot more going on behind the scenes than we realized. And, I mean, we've learned it, which I see as a benefit because it means that we can debate it. It's fairly clear that terrorists have learned it too. And, you know, in the last few days, there's been quite a bit of stuff about the leaders of ISIS telling their followers, be careful of your metadata because the Americans are listening. there's a benefit and a cost here. I am sensitive to the cost, although I think that, we're doing too much of this.
I'm interested now, given where we're at and the history we've been talking about, where we're at now, where are the former KGB operations? Do they still exist? I guess the Russian one does. And are they as capable as the West?
Russia today has a successor organization of the KGB, the FSB, and a foreign intelligence service. Essentially what they did was they split their intelligence service into two, so they now have a separate domestic counterintelligence agency and a foreign intelligence agency. There's essentially been no break. If you look at some of the former Soviet states, they had a real break with the past. They got rid of the old communist officials. that hasn't happened in Russia, as we know. The Russian leadership today is full of former KGB types. The KGB archives in Moscow remain secret, and Putin has just signed another law extending that secrecy for another 30 years.
Wow.
So there's a very strong element of continuity. There's also, I think, a lot of people in the KGB who, you know, they went through a bad time in the 90s and the early 2000s when the reputation of the KGB was being rubbished by historians, exposing its crimes and the suppression of human rights and so on. And essentially, they want to prove that they're still in business and still doing a good job. How to compare the competence of the Russian intelligence agencies today with Western intelligence agencies, that's beyond me. I'm not in a position to do that.
Right.
But it's definitely still in business.
How did they handle it, the collapse of the Soviet Empire? That must have gone against everything all these organizations were set up to preserve. It must have been difficult for the people involved to accept the situation and deal with it, with, you know, young people breaking down the wall and all that sort of stuff going on.
I think very, very difficult. And if you look at the memoirs of these people, the few interviews that they've given, a very strong feeling is actually ingratitude, that they were just trying to do a job protecting society, protecting people from themselves, stopping people from being confused by Western ideas and taken off away from the flock. And now society has turned its back on them and spurned them. And but I think psychologically it was very, very difficult for them. And so I think, you know, that accentuates all the more the sense of we're back now that Russia has gone back to a relatively authoritarian system, great power aspirations, to some extent throwing its weight around. Yes.
Right. We're back, so watch out. All right. And just one final question in the minute we have left, for someone like yourself looking at these documents, going through these archives, it must be an amazing feeling just looking back. You're looking at the way people's lives were tracked and the way society works. Do you have any overarching impression or comment to make on that to us before we sign off?
Oh, it's you know, I feel incredibly fortunate to have had this chance. For two reasons. I mean, one is because it's a little part of my own history, because I lived through the Cold War, I was a student in Moscow. It answers a lot of questions that we used to ask ourselves, you know, we're students, are they interested in us, do they follow us, do they care who we meet, what stories we tell? The answers to all those questions are clearly yes. And but the other thing is just, it's, to me, an astonishing insight into this organization that controlled people in a very methodical, calculating way. There are times when I just read these documents, and the first time I began to immerse themselves in, I just thought, you know, Reagan was right. This was an evil empire. But it's
also Reagan was right.
There's something about the casual, professional way in which they set about controlling people, destroying their lives, destroying their confidence in their friends, isolating them, manipulating them. It's creepy stuff, and I deal with it by writing about it.
Yeah.
I don't want you to feel sorry for me. This is the most fun I've ever had in my professional career as an academic. It's just this wonderful sandbox to play in.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
I think Reagan also said that they would end up in the ashtray of history. I don't know if that quite happened that way, but I guess the regime did.
Yes, but as you can tell, it's still smouldering. You know, the fire is not out.
Nice to talk to you, Mark. We appreciate you giving us the hour today. It was fantastic.
Well, thank you.
Okay. And that was Professor Mark Harrison, Hoover Fellow. And the Hoover Connection is the Hoover Archives Workshop on Totalitarian Regimes. He's from the University of Warwick, and he's had unprecedented access to the 1.5 million plus pages of documents, etc., which form the Lithuanian KGB collection. Hope you enjoyed. found fascinating that conversation.